The Grade 2 Conference, Lecture 6, The Second Grader, Part 6. Let's look now at how we can work with the temperaments in Grade 2. First of all, for the first third of the year, you should do everything possible to seat like with like. So you should have, let's say, to your right, especially if you're a righty, the two or three cholerics who are in the class. To your left, you should have the five or six sanguines in the class seated near each other. Behind them, you can have the five or six phlegmatics who are in the class. And then finally, behind the cholerics, the eight or nine melancholics who are in the class. Put them in groupings like that. Now, the numbers I've just given you, you think, well, he's just making that up, you know, off the top of his head. Did you notice how many cholerics I said were in the class? I said two. I'm assuming your class is 24, let's say. And this is something that I say again and again, and people just don't want to hear it. I say that you will never, 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 unless you have some incredibly difficult destiny in store for you, you're never going to have more than 10% of a class who's choleric, which means two or three cholerics. And I know what you're saying right now. My class is so choleric. The kindergarten teachers told me my class was choleric. You know, all I can say is that people in the Waldorf movement use the term choleric to mean difficult, to mean unimaginable, unmanageable, to mean somebody who disagrees with me all the time, to mean someone who's rude or entitled. You know, there are all kinds of human failings that irritate us or that make other people difficult to be with. All temperaments are capable of experiencing some degree of anger, and all temperaments are capable of getting in trouble and misbehaving. That doesn't mean that they're choleric. And just because a teacher, present company excepted, of course, just because a teacher can't manage a group of children doesn't mean it's because those children are choleric. It may just mean because that person shouldn't be a teacher. They can't manage a group of children of all and any temperaments. So the reality is we don't really meet that many cholerics because the choleric temperament is so challenging to have as one's own temperament. It's so difficult to integrate into any kind of social group, classroom or whatever, that cholerics come down to us, we could say, from the spiritual world in homeopathic numbers. Because, number one, they're so difficult, and because, number two, one choleric in terms of what he or she can do for the world once they get their act together, there's no guarantee they will, but if they do, that one choleric can be worth their weight in 5 or 10 children of another temperament. The choleric temperament is very important. Steiner has said that the world cannot change, that great changes in the world, the founding of a new culture like Romulus and Remus founding Rome, the beginning of a new religion like Zarathustra forming the religion of the ancient Persians, that these things can only be accomplished by cholerics, that it is the cholerics who truly wreak the great, great changes that move the world forward, not only historically, culturally, but we might even say in an evolutionary way. And so you don't need a whole lot, But those that you have, you have to look at every choleric that you encounter, and especially those in your class. Here is someone who potentially could change the world, but they're not going to be able to do it unless I help them find their way into that world, unless I help them bring that warmth one iota more deeply into their other bodies so that they can really be integrated, that they can find their way to be truly productive and helpful individuals. So you don't want four cholerics. You would not be able to handle five cholerics. I assure you, you'd be a nervous wreck. And it's the kind of class, you know, where there'd be eight class teachers in 8 years. Couldn't happen. But two, yeah. Even three, you should be able to do that. But let's go back now to the melancholics for a moment. And who, as you noticed, they were the largest number, right? Now, this is very interesting. A.C. Harwood, in his wonderful book, The Recovery of Man in Childhood, or something to that effect, the first major book written about Waldorf education in the English language in the 1930s, he described the composition of a classroom in terms of percentages of temperaments and said, of course, the sanguines constitute the largest number of any single temperament because childhood is inherently sanguine in nature. So we would see more sanguinity in children. You know, very logical, very thoughtful, and I'm sure that in those years it was very true. But I think that one of the most obvious images for us to hold about how changed our world is right now is the fact that the percentage of sanguines in a given class has gone down and the percentage of melancholics has gone up, way up. It's not unusual for you to have 30 to 35% of the class melancholic, not 20 or 25%. Smallest number is choleric, largest number is melancholic. Because when a melancholic temperament is transformed in later years, it very often leads to an individual who brings a lot of compassion, a lot of empathy into the world. An individual who is drawn much more than any other temperament into healing, into human services, into social work. And clearly in our time, such individuals are needed more than ever. It's interesting, as I tell you that the melancholic temperament is the largest, fastest growing temperament. It's a real growth industry in a way in the Waldorf School. What is the fastest growing industry in the United States in this early 21st century time? Healthcare. Every domain, every branch of healthcare is growing faster than ever. So here you have it. The melancholics have come, not necessarily to grow rich and successful because they're involved in healthcare, but because we realize that we all need tending. We all need TLC. And it's the melancholics who grow up to be able to do this. So, a very important, very central way of working with the melancholic child in the class is to appeal to their sympathy for others. They're already very sympathetic to themselves. They feel every ache and pain. They come to school with headaches two or three times a week. The other days when they don't have headaches, they have stomach aches. There's always something. Dark bags under the eyes. I didn't sleep at all last night. My parents were arguing, or my mother isn't feeling well, or I think my father's in the hospital now. They're convinced always, and it's not always incorrect either. because they've chosen their family, they've chosen their destiny, it may be that they do experience truly more physical pain, more social pain than other children in the class. You don't want to take that pain away from them because that's the consciousness that they have of their internal life. Don't deny that. You're not in there. You don't know what they're experiencing. But take that energy that feels pain and make it, I feel your pain. You know, so put them in situations via stories, let's say, when you tell the sad parts in the stories of saints or in the fables. Be sure that your attention, your eyes, or at least your consciousness is directed towards the melancholics in the room. So this confirms in a way for them, yes, life is sad. Life is very difficult. You'll also notice, for example, the melancholic, like the phlegmatic, is a slow eater. The phlegmatic eats slowly because he is relishing every bite he is taking. It's just the high point of his day. The melancholic eats slowly because any kind of physical activity, even just grinding one's teeth and swallowing, is something of a task and has a little quality of pain and tedium about it. But there they are in the classroom together, and everyone else is out for recess. A child runs in the room. Mr. Schwartz, Sally just fell, and she's out there, and she's crying. And it's amazing. The phlegmatic, undeterred, keeps eating. Oh, Mr. Schwartz will take care of that one. The melancholic is out in a flash. And while other children are just standing there watching this child crying, the melancholic already has her arm around her. Here, stand up. I'll take you to the nurse. You'll be okay. By the time you've gotten out there, the melancholic's already halfway to the nurse's room with that child. Or the children leave a mess behind and you say, I'm going to have to call everyone in from recess. This classroom is inexcusable. The melancholic will say, don't worry, I'll clean it up. Let them play. They all just like to play. That's all they care about. And I'll clean the room up. It's all right. So there they go. The melancholic's great joy is to take on other people's suffering, other people's infractions, other people's sins, we might say. And one can sort of smile at that, but, you know, that's not an entirely bad social skill to have today. We could all use a little bit of that, and that's what the melancholic is able to bring. So look for those situations, and that will help the melancholic find his or her way into the social life of the class. When it comes to the quality of schoolwork, the melancholic carries remarkable contradictions. On the one hand, her frailty will probably lead her to be absent from school more than others. You know, if you look at the roll book and look at the children who are absent, not just one day, but 2 or 3 days in a row, or 2 weeks or something like that, you're going to generally find those are the melancholic children. So they tend to miss a lot of school. And this is doubly painful for them, not only that they're sick, but also that they're missing school, because melancholics are scholars. They really love to learn about things. They really are interested in understanding and knowing things, because it gives them more evidence that life is filled with misery and pain. So they hate to miss school. They come back to school. They're 4 days, 6 days, 8 days behind in their work. And generally, you're not going to send work home to them because you have to explain what they need to do. And what's amazing is how rapidly they make that work up. And by the end of the year, for all of his absences, that melancholic boy has beautiful morning lesson books, caught up completely. They stay in at recess, they take them home, they get careful instructions from you about what to do. So generally, they are very hard workers and they're going to do very well. What you're going to notice in second grade is that especially if they start working with stick crayons, they're going to make all of the figures very El Greco-like, very thin. Their own formative forces are going to work very strongly. So you want to help the melancholic. Certainly they need to do some of those thin figures because that's a reflection of their own being, but also help them flesh them out a little bit. Give them methods, give them techniques in which they can start to round out their figures and make them larger. And this will help the melancholic take a very big step forward in the work that she does. And also at home, I always tell the parents, you know, think of what a child can do. You always want to be giving second grade parents ideas for chores, for things, work that the children can do at home. This is very, very important. Because especially in our time, unless you're living in a really rural farm district, most children who go to Waldorf schools lead fairly entitled, I won't say spoiled, lives at home. And such spoiled, I mean entitled children need to learn how to do some things at home. So what can a melancholic do around the dinner table, around dinner time? Basically not much. Let them clean up afterwards. Let them clear the table and bring everybody's messy used utensils and plates into the kitchen, and perhaps let them help. Maybe at first it's just drying, and then you teach them little by little the fine points of washing some dishes. But this is what melancholics will be very happy to do. Not so much creating the meal, not so much entering into the joy-filled social discourse of the meal, but cleaning up afterwards. So it's not anything demeaning to them. It's something that they understand is a necessary part of life. Tending that which has, in a way, fallen out of life, because their temperament can really relate to that. So give that advice to parents. The other is the question of the cleaning of the child's room. If they haven't learned much about that yet, second grade is an important time for children to start to take hold of their own rooms. But not every child can do it in the same way. So for the melancholic, don't ask them to clean their own room. They won't do it. And they can get very messy and sort of be hoarders and pack rats in certain ways. Have them help you clean the mess in your room. And then you help them clean their room. That's a real key. At the end of the year, I never had to ask. I knew when it was time to start moving things out of my classroom to bring them over to the next grade's classroom for the year to come, that melancholics would offer to help me move everything and organize everything and so on. The melancholics did more of the moving, and the sanguines like to do the organization, but we'll hear a little bit about them in the next lecture. So let's leave our beloved little melancholics and go on to how to work with a phlegmatic child in grade 2.